So thank you. It's great to be here. As you say, what I'm going to try and talk about today is about why this year matters for security and conflict resolution. And just because security is a word that looks simple but does not translate between countries, I will tell you. When we talk about security, we're not talking about just the military. We're talking about everything to energy, food, migration, the broad sense of security as spoken by of heads of government, as opposed to includes the military, but not just hard security. So that's what I want to talk about today. I'm going to not go through all the slides, but they'll be circulated later because some of this is just meant to be an impression. A slightly diverse audience. I have to go through some stuff people may have seen before. Otherwise, it won't make any sense. And if you're wondering why there's an egg with the world painted on it on the slide, we'll get to that later. So just to say, this analysis is based on a wide range of E3G's work, including our work on security here and in Europe, on security strategies, but we also do kind of quite deep political analysis around the UNFCCC process and climate diplomacy and political economy mapping of key countries, though most of our work is actually trying to change energy and diplomatic policy in countries. So this is kind of the top notes of a lot of depth, so I'd be very interested to answer more deep questions. What am I going to say? Always good to start with the end. 2015 matters. We all know climate change is impacting security this year across not just the Paris negotiations and climate change, but the Sustainable Development Goals, Montreal Protocol. We'll have a material impact not just on the forward look, but also on immediate economic, geopolitical, and budgetary priorities. And that's the important one, budgetary priorities. That gets people's attention. But it's not the Super Bowl or the Cup Final, as I would really say. Because we're not going to get an end state regime where we can say we are definitely on a track to 2 degrees or off a track to 2 degrees, we've solved it, not solved it. But we need to do enough. We need to do enough to not be in a very risky space on climate risk. We need to deliver investment certainty, because that's what matters, and public confidence. And the third bullet point I've never written before. The US is successfully shaping the climate regime. It's nice to have you back. Sorry, Europe's kind of disappeared. But yeah, US diplomacy has worked, and it is shaping other people's positions, especially China and India. But we're still a bit worried about whether you're here for stay. And talking to senior politicians, there's a fear of backsliding in US diplomacy. Are the promises you're making really going to be redeemable from 2020 to 2030? Because as things change, yeah. And the last point is that we need to integrate security in this broader sense, into the climate regime. Because it's a foundation of bilateral relationships. It's already affecting US and other planning and deployments. But there's really massive opportunity, we think, for reforms which would improve stability and security, reduce pressure on both the European and US militaries, but also strengthen alliance and resilience. So that's where I want to go today. It's a bit of climate science. It's not really climate science, but I think just a few high notes. You probably haven't seen this graph. This is temperature proxy for the last 100,000 years. The climate is not stable. Human civilization, agriculture, is the bit at the top that is stable. We did not get agriculture because we got clever. We got agriculture because the climate got stable and it became a good survival approach. So just realize that. The climate is bouncy. And this is carbon dioxide over 100,000, I'd say nearly a million years going back. One of the drivers of that fluctuation is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There are others. We are pushing it, if you see where the dots are, way, way outside where it's been for the last million years. Something, it's got a risky, bouncy, volatile system, which we only have advanced civilization when it's stable, and we're now pushing that system, one of the core drivers of that system, way outside geological boundaries. And this is real climate science, is climate modeling. So this is, often people say, oh, we need to keep things within 2 degrees. That is a meaningless statement without any qualifications. How much probability? Uncertainty is everywhere. So these are probability distributions of, and there's temperature on the y-axis, three scenarios of how much carbon we put in the atmosphere. So the first one, which is the highest emission scenario, that would give me a 50% chance of being below 3 degrees C, but as you see, a 10% chance of being around 6 to 7 degrees. That's double the last ice age difference, just to give you a broad idea of what that means. So if someone says, well, 2 is a bit difficult, should we go to 3? That's what that means in risk terms. If you say, well, half, 50-50 chance of 2, that's okay. That gives us a 10% chance of 4 to 5. Still one ice age away the wrong way. You think large climatic changes. You have to be at 66% chance of being below 2 degrees C to minimize risk. The UK, though we sign up to the 2-degree global goal, signed up by all global leaders, that's not our national policy. Our national policy is limiting the risk of 4 degrees to a 1% chance, because we think that's more meaningful in terms of managing our climate security. So the 2 degrees, 66% kind of translates to that. But realize, you've got to understand the risk if you know what you're planning for. And why does that matter? I mean, we can talk about impacts, but this is tipping points for those of you who understand tipping points to say, what parts of the global system which regulate the climate, whether it's the Antarctic, or Greenland ice sheets, or the Amazon, or the monsoons in West Africa or India, will flip irreversibly at what temperature? We don't know much about this, to be honest. This is one scientist's or scientific group's estimate. Red means more likely than not. White means won't happen. Yellow, you know, somewhere between 50% and 50%. At 2 degrees, everything's in the low probability range. You go up to 4 degrees, most of those tipping points, which lead to runaway climate change, are in the more likely than not range. That's why we have a policy in the UK of keeping 4 degrees below 1%. So again, if you want to understand what risk we're taking, which is what security analysts do, you have to understand these basics. This is the kind of top level, because the whole metric for the rest of the talk is, how close are we to maintaining reliably below 2 degrees? What's this regime doing us for limiting our risk? So we have to know what risks we care about. I'm not going to go through the links between climate change and security, because lots of much more important people than me have said what they are, and people probably know them. But the top takeaway at the bottom is quite good. A new foreign policy poll that 41% of US experts think climate change is a top US foreign policy priority. Surprised me. I'm not sure if you get the same result in Europe, but it shows that it's not a controversial issue, which when we started doing this in the mid-2000s, it was. But again, what does that really mean? What does that really mean in practice? It means that the past won't be a guide to the future, and old models. Climate change is going to change how we work together, our relationships, our interests, our borders, our economic advantages, the public's confidence in the UN system, a whole lot of areas. It's not just conflict and instability on the ground, it's how the whole global system works to project stability, resilience, peace. That's on the big picture. And it requires us to take a much more preventative approach, again, not just on reducing climate emissions, but also building resilience into systems. We can't just learn by doing, because it will be too late. What does that mean in practical examples? Well, it's always interesting to look back at your old work and see how correct you were. Of course, I've chosen one where I was right, so that's a bit of a cheat. But in 2008, we said, everybody was talking about climate and conflict, we said, but think about it, climate change is going to change our trade balance issues, our energy security as we move from cooperating with fuel producers to clean technology producers. Unconventional oil will be a contentious political issue. No one knew about unconventional oil in 2008. It was kind of a geek's issue. It'll disrupt markets. It may undermine trade rules. It may drive global resentment. Osama bin Laden had just given a statement demonizing the US on climate change policy. So that was what we thought the future might hold. I think we thought this would happen around 10 or 15 years. By 2015, that's the world we live in now. This is real. Climate change is a major element of US, China, and US India diplomacy and European diplomacy. 80% of Europe's trade defense instruments, so countervailing duties, are on low carbon goods in 2013. A large amount of that solar, but a lot of other things. 80%. Why? Because these are subsidized industries. We have had some really brutal disputes with China and the US on how, including aviation in our emissions trading system, and with Canada on tar sands regulation. Really high level bribery threats. Horrible stuff. And our finance regulators are looking at whether the UK stock market will become unstable due to being overexposed to carbon stocks. That's what it looks like on the economic sphere. It's very real. On energy security, we're not going to build any new gas pipelines in Europe because our energy demand's falling because we have really good efficiency policy. That changes our relationship with Russia completely. It's a massive debate at the moment. 2008, we saw how extreme events, coupled with people putting export bans on, so trade responses, drove food prices and instability around the world. We ran that scenario 5 years before, and everybody said, oh, it'll never happen. Trade will stay flowing. The rules will be obeyed. Didn't happen. The Mediterranean is full of refugees driven by conflict, exacerbated by drought, and Arctic politics continue to grow. And we are seeing a massive growth of government repression of anti-coal activism, including in India, but also in places like Poland and Turkey, in our democratic friends. We're seeing a global fossil divestment campaign look like the anti-apartheid movement, and we saw 40,000 people march in Copenhagen and 400,000 people march in Paris. And there'll be a lot more people. So in New York, there'll be a lot more people in Paris because the organizers tell me there'll be a lot more people. So this is a big issue, and I don't think that's reflected so much. And it's happened faster than we thought. And again, hotspots, a lot of issues about the Middle East, South Asia, water-driven conflicts, and Jeff knows much more about this than I do. We know where the problems are. The analysis is pretty clear across all NATO countries. We all basically agree where the stress is. Two takeaways why it matters. For the EU, it's our neighborhood. If that's a water stress map, red is bad. The EU neighbors at high risk. It's high risk anyway, but trying to build stability in politically unstable countries which have too many people, too little water, no energy, and no markets is a challenge for Europe. But perhaps people don't realize the challenge, particularly for the US, is it's probably the most domestically vulnerable OECD country. The 37% of damages over the last, from extreme weather events over the last 30 years have been in the US, half of that in Europe. We're a much more populated and larger country than you are, or region. You are very exposed. 10 years ago, we would have said the opposite. We would have said that Europe is more vulnerable than the US. So in our domestic interests, that's where we come through. So why does climate diplomacy matter? That's what the risk landscape is. Climate diplomacy matters because we need climate agreements to work. Why do we need climate agreements to work? Because to get below 2 degrees, we need to shift $90 trillion of investment from high carbon, which is going at the moment, to low carbon, efficient, and resilient investment. And most of that is in developing countries, around 70 to 80%. So to preserve European and US security, we have to persuade other people to change the way they build their cities, their power stations, their roads, their transport systems, their economies. That's why we need diplomacy, because we cannot control it. We cannot force them to do it. We have to persuade them to do it. So that's why we need an agreement that manages climate risk, sends strong signals on investment, gives confidence we're all behaving, transparency and confidence. And we also have a ratchet if we're not going to get to 2 degrees so we can get ambition moving in the future. And we've made a lot of progress. Again, this is not about one little treaty in Paris. The climate regime contains a huge number of institutions. I won't go through all of them, but not just in negotiations, but implementing through major areas like the Green Climate Fund, ICAO, integrating into the Security Council, the World Bank's work. We have huge networks of civil society, cities, businesses engaged. And there's a little drawing of that. This is a very pared down view of the global climate regime. So when we talk about a regime, that's what we're talking about. Those institutions organized by the conversation in the middle, which is the global climate conversation, that says how much we're trying to do. But the doing is done in a lot of other places. So again, people say, oh, top down, bottom up, in the UN, outside the UNFCCC. Dead questions. This is the reality. We are driving a multi-level, multi-institutional, broad, complicated regime, which takes an awful lot of diplomacy to make it work. And the bottom line is we don't have that diplomacy in place. All the people to do it, political leadership to do it, if we want to achieve what we said we want to do. But the good thing is the wind's at our back. Things have changed a lot since Copenhagen, and mostly in the right direction, in the real world. People get that climate change is impacting now in the way they didn't before Copenhagen. Unfortunately, we've also probably breached a tipping point in the West Antarctic ice shelf. At least part of it is now irreversibly melting. We just don't know how quickly. So more sea level rise than we were expecting. Resource prices will remain volatile, and so countries are looking at efficiency as a major national security issue which has strong climate change byproducts. And lots of middle-income countries are taking large economic reforms in the next 5 to 10 years, which makes it easier to reorientate their economies. And around 50% to 90% of what they need to do to keep on a 2-degree track makes sense nationally in terms of health effects, pollution effects, energy security effects, and just saving money. So it's not pushing against economic logic. It's not expensive. It's quite hard to do. And the last one is renewable energy prices have dropped faster than anybody expected, and deployments are much faster. The only people who predicted the pace of renewable energy diffusion were Greenpeace, and Greenpeace underestimated how fast it was going to go in their most radical scenario. So there you are. People didn't estimate it. And also we're seeing power shift. So power and climate politics are shifting. In 1990, China had a quarter per capita emissions of the EU. Now we have the same emissions. We're seeing a shift from a north-south discussion in negotiations to a combination of countries who are vulnerable, talking to countries who are who are climate makers, who put the emissions out there. And that's not complete, but it's a drift, and it's a change in dynamics. The economic opportunities are growing. There's around a $5 trillion low-carbon economy out there. We're looking at liberalization in a lot of agreements, including WTO and TTIP. And again, investment is a battleground, and that's another area the rise of the BRICS Bank and the Asian Investment Bank, and what's the role of the World Bank? Will they compete over building infrastructure in countries? Will they maintain environmental safeguards? How do we make sure we don't have a battle for influence over who's going to build people's airports or roads, which undermines our agenda on climate change? That's a big issue, and we have been discussing this with the administration. What's the stance towards these new international institutions? How do they align with our agreed, because we've agreed with China on this, and all of the BRICS countries, agreed goals? So, and Paris is going to be different to the previous agreements. It was always meant to be. It's what Kyoto was meant to evolve into. It will have legal force, but I'll leave it to the lawyers to tell you what that means. It'll apply to everybody. Everybody will make an effort. Everybody will do something without being paid. We will probably have a review mechanism so we can ratchet up ambition as climate change changes. And we will may have a goal of zero emissions. I'm not precisely sure, but there'll be a lot of fights over it. And if a country doesn't obey their rules, they can be sanctioned under WTO unilaterally. There's nothing stopping us. So it's the system we were looking to evolve to. Unfortunately, when we game the negotiations, this is the one output from a lot of gaming we did with negotiations. The purple line is what we need to do to get to 2 degrees. The dots, the green dot is business as usual. The red dot and the cross are two different scenarios. We're probably likely to go somewhere between the two. We will be a long way away from 2 degrees. Happy to answer questions on where we got that from, but it's pretty resilient. We've tested it with a lot of people. We are not going to get 2 degrees. So where does that leave us? There's no slam dunk 2 degrees. We might get a deal in the room, but that's not a success if it doesn't persuade investors and leave us on a high impact trajectory. We could still crash and have Copenhagen 2. We need to be able to put some more money on the table or some more finance in order to persuade countries to push, particularly developing countries, vulnerable countries, to push China for stronger rules and a meaningful review process. But we also need to build beyond Paris. This isn't the end game. We need to build the coalitions that will deliver before then. And that's where US diplomacy and climate, the security community can be really useful. So the US has delivered a lot this year in moving China, even if it's not enough. It's helped in Europe, it's helped with China and India. Sorry to kind of flip through this, but you can read them later. This is an estimate of what action might have done, but it's got a health warning. That red line, the blue face at the top, says what we were kind of going to, 3 to 6, 4.2 degrees. If we implemented the pledges on the table toward Paris to 2030 and ran them out to 2100, you might get around 3 degrees. That's a big difference in climate risk. That is not politically stable, because that would assume China caps its emissions and we, Europe and US, go to zero emissions. That's what they modeled, which isn't politically sustainable. But it's interesting, you can reduce exposure. It works if people deliver, but it's still way away from where you need to be on 2 degrees. So things matter, and though people still worry, they say, if it's not legally binding, if you're not tied into it, will Congress reverse it? What does that mean for our energy policy? Can we reverse it? There's a lot of disquiet, and a lot of the caution in China and the caution in Europe comes from half believing the US. So people are being positive, but also retaining an ability to step back. So it's quite important for people to see a domestic political consensus form in the US, because that gives more confidence that it won't be blown off course. And understanding US national interests in terms of security is one of the things we talk about with other governments about why the US is more likely than not to keep its promises, because it understands its national interests both domestically and internationally is at risk. But what would be the security implications of failure? Just because it's good sometimes to look over the abyss to see where you are. At the moment, we are not in a really bad failure place, but we are not over the line of success. And that's a general view of senior negotiators in a negotiation. It's not my view. And so that's not going to help the security community. It's not going to keep risk below levels which are unmanageable. It's not going to help build cooperation around resilience. Because if we're not cooperating on mitigation, we're not going to cooperate on resilience. We will defend ourselves. We'll fall back. And it will also impact cooperation in other areas. Let's skip through that. So what might happen if we did some of the worst scenarios for Paris? Well, there will be a big chill on energy investment for those of you in the economy. Clean energy is around 0.3 to 0.7% of GDP in the major economies, and they're political markets, and political uncertainty chills investment. you would see an unraveling of European climate legislation, for example, which would mean our energy policy was on hold for 3 or 4 years while we digested Paris. That is not good for our economies. There would also be a lot of pressure to block goods from China, and a lot of pressure on the rules-based regime. So there's going to be economic consequences. There would be geopolitical consequences. What do we do if we fail to agree China, the major carbon power, and integrate it into a rules-based system? What will happen there? There'd be a major blow to European confidence, and I do not see TTIP passing in a world where Paris failed, because public opposition to it is so strong and is very tied to the green movement, environmental movement. It would see as an unbalanced agreement. And I think we'd see a drop of public belief that the international system could deliver stability and security. This is the big multilateral game in town. It's the one big one left. Is it really going to deliver for people? So it supports kind of defensive geopolitics area. It would also undermine things like the US-Philippines relationship, an area where climate change and impacts and response from the US military and military relationships come together. And we can perhaps talk about that more. We're seeing you can't look like you're not supporting someone else's national interest and expect to support your national interest. And Philippines have made some pretty big political moves in the climate negotiations, encouraged heavily by the administration to distance itself from China and India, who are its neighbors. So those alliances are now completely wrapped together: security, diplomacy, climate change. And I'm going to just pop through this. So, and on security and stability, what would this mean the day after Paris? Well, the day after Paris, in the security world, you'd have to raise all your planning assumptions for strategic risk, for bases, for equipment, for disaster response load. Because you can't assume we're going to control risk. You have to look at some of those high-risk 5-6 degree scenarios. We would see adaptation pullback. You know, Europe would pull back its adaptation to its borders, not look at Africa. There'd be no point, to be honest, to try and do adaptation in Africa if you're in these extreme scenarios. So you would start to have the ungoverned spaces issue coming out really strongly. And the idea we were cooperating on global resilience, food security, transboundary water agreements, disaster response. So we would be in crisis overload, and we're already in a bit of crisis overload at the moment. So that's a nasty scenario. So that's why we want to make sure this works. But there's also an opportunity. We could make this regime support, a security-supporting regime, in the broadest sense. And here's something, we could make it monitor extreme risks better. It's not very good at monitoring risks, particularly on social economic risks. We could help reduce risks, responding to the worst-case scenarios, and we could have better managing risks in terms of international cooperation. And one of the discussions we've been having in Washington is, what do we do this year? There is a G7 foreign minister, Jeff is involved in it, discussing climate security. What could they agree, which would show we're building resilience, we're building a balanced regime that doesn't just reduce emissions and doesn't care about poor countries. A lot of poor countries think we don't care about them. And that makes them very distrustful of us in the negotiations. So this has a negotiation benefit and a security benefit. Well, we could agree that we were going to put conflict sensitivity and all adaptation response. We could, particularly post-conflict reconstruction, where actually we tend to build in instability through our response in, say, Pakistan. We could put much more funding into monitoring systems, and I know there's some work ongoing here and in the UK on this, looking at stress in fragile areas. Environmental refugees, rights and responsibilities, transboundary water and fisheries agreements. And who's going to drive this? Who's going to drive the institutional reform? You know, you can't be driven from Washington or London or Berlin or Paris. Do we argue the UN Secretary General should have more powers, a special representative? Whose role is it? Because if there's no one doing it, it's not going to get done. So again, not the whole system, it's not going to be done in a day, but just trying to start building a parallel effort on resilience. Security has to have a strong stake in the outcome of the Paris climate negotiations and the other processes this year. And the first one is how to support, by making the consequences of failure clear, keeping 2 degrees credibly within reach. I see lots of writing from the foreign policy community about how important TTIP is. TTIP is a fly speck economically compared to Paris. I'm happy to go into the numbers. It is tiny and unimportant, but we see far more attention focused on that as a foundation of the new rules order than the Paris regime, which I think is economically and geopolitically much more important. That's a choice. Why? Because there's a stronger community arguing on trade. And so that's why we need security and foreign policy actors to make that case and keep this on the priority agenda, because I'm telling you, it isn't. Unless Kerry or Obama are in the room, it's not on the top list after Ukraine, ISIS, terrorism. There's a lot of distractions in 2015, and short-term issues are important, but they're not everything. But also this positive agenda gives us a chance to build something stronger and better and really argue for a broader based regime that is not so led by environment ministries and not so led focused on mitigation. And coming back, the urgent cannot displace the important. Which means we finally get to the egg, which I promised I'd come back to. So the egg is what I always present to especially senior leaders to say, you can get lots of science, but in the end, this is a gut decision. If only the world is fragile, the climate system is fragile, it's like an egg. And it has massive tipping points. We know that from the past. We know from the geology. So it's near the edge of a table. And we know we're poking it by raising carbon emissions, because we know carbon emissions are way above where they've been over the last 1 million, 2 million years. And so the question is, you know, this is it. In your gut, how much climate risk do you take? How much do you want to poke that egg? Are you going to fall off the table? Is the table high off the ground or low off the ground? Is it a hard-boiled egg or a soft-boiled egg? Because unless you have a gut feeling of how much risk you're going to take, you will not prioritize this to reduce that risk. And at the moment, we do not have that discussion at the top level, in the officials' discussions across the Atlantic, or at the public. And that's why we're not going to get a two-degree agreement in Paris, not because we don't know how to do it, but because we haven't built the political consensus that that's a risk worth avoiding, so we're not going to avoid it. And again, I think the security and foreign policy community is quite good at talking about risk and having public conversations about risk, and that's where post-Paris we need to take this work so we actually do avoid the unmanageable, as John Holdren says. Thank you very much.